Would you be willing to still follow Jesus if it meant you were going to lose precious things? Because if we're not, I'd like to suggest that perhaps our faith is not a real faith. I'd like to suggest that maybe we're involved in some sort of a mutually beneficial relationship that is not really likened to marriage. It's kind of more like friendship with benefits. Shacking up with Jesus. As long as he's good to me, I'll hang around. But if he starts making demands, he starts doing things or disappointing me, I'm out of here. He starts making requirements of me or taking up too much of my time, listen, I'm done. Forget your father's house and your people and give yourself wholeheartedly to your bridegroom. And if you do, you'll find him to be intoxicated with your beauty. Now, let's turn to Matthew 26. Ready? Let's go. Matthew 26. And let's have a look at someone who did that. And someone who didn't. Matthew 26. Now, just a little brief introduction. Matthew is not writing a chronologically accurate order of events, sequence of events here. What he's doing is he's employing a tactic that's kind of like in our modern movies today where you have a flashback to something. Anybody see the recent Bourne movies? Or what was the new one called? Bourne what? Legacy. I like those movies. I'm not endorsing that for you, and I'm not saying you should let your children see that, but I enjoyed that movie. Anyway, in the movie, there are flashbacks to previous movies, and if you hadn't seen the other movies, you would not know what's going on. Okay, you ever seen that, something like that on TV or in the theater? So you got to pay attention to the flashback, because usually it's interpreting what's happening right now, so you can understand it better. Matthew employs that tactic right here in Matthew 26, and what you're going to see is a little bit of a sandwich. See if you can recognize it as we read. Matthew chapter 26, verses 1 through 16. Now it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these sayings that he said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days is the Passover, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified. Then the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders of the people assembled at the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and plotted to take Jesus by trickery and kill him. But they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people. And when Jesus was in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, a woman came to him having an alabaster flask of very costly fragrant oil, and she poured it on his head as he sat at the table. But when his disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, to what purpose is this waste? For this fragrant oil might have been sold for much and given to the poor. But when Jesus was aware of it, he said to them, why do you trouble the woman? For she has done a good work for me. But you have the poor with you always. For you have the poor with you always, but me you do not always have. For in pouring this fragrant oil on my body, she did it for my burial. Assuredly, I say to you, wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be told as a memorial to her. Then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, what are you willing to give me if I deliver him to you? And they counted out to him 30 pieces of silver. So from that time, he sought opportunity to betray him. Well, thank you, Lord, for your word. Make it come alive, I pray. Okay, so here we have this little thing. Can you see could you see the flashback in the middle? Let me explain why it's a flashback. That story, the story of the fragrant oil and the alabaster jar and of the betrayal, is told in the different gospel accounts. You guys know that there are four gospels, right? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, right? Each of those four gospels addresses the story of Jesus from a different angle. Some contain repeats of the same stories. Wording may be slightly different. Sometimes the words are identical. But then other times there are stories told that are not in the other ones. And so you kind of put them all together and you can link a sort of a chronological timeline. You can see, you can get there. Luke usually is pretty much accurate with his timeline. And then John's gospel is written way after the other three were written, probably, you know, half a century later. And he writes from a slightly different perspective. He kind of looks at things from a more spiritual, a more poetic perspective, and it's very beautiful. The writing of John is just really beautiful. There are things about Jesus that he explains that the others did not explain. So reading all four gospels gives you an overview. Everybody get the picture. Okay, this story is told almost the same way in the Gospel of Mark. Almost identical. The Gospel of Luke doesn't tell the story, and the Gospel of John does tell the story, but tells it differently. Here's how it is in the Gospel of John, and this is why we know that that event that's sandwiched in between Caiaphas and the rulers of the people plotting against Jesus and Judas deciding to turn him over for 30 pieces of silver, that little story in the middle about the fragrant oil, that actually took place 6 days prior to the Passover, and it happened in a town called Bethany, which is on the east side of Jerusalem, just over the Mount of Olives, about a Sabbath day's journey from the city. And it was there that Jesus stopped off on his way into the city before the triumphal entry. He was staying with Mary, Martha, and Lazarus in that town called Bethany. In fact, John tells the same story, and he names the woman. She's not named in Matthew. Did you notice that? She's not given a name, and she's not given a name in the book of Mark. Luke tells a similar story, but it's in a different context. So just to make sure you don't get mixed up in the two stories, that they do have a correlation, and I think it's important for us to see that, but it's not the same account. In the Gospel of Luke, the story is told in Luke chapter 7, I believe it is, and it's in a different place altogether. In the Galilee, you have a woman who brings a fragrant oil, and she pours it out at Jesus' feet. But different story. It's the house of Simon the Pharisee, different guy. This is Simon the leper. It's in the Galilee. This is in Bethany, which is in just outside of Jerusalem, totally different geographical area. That woman was a sinner, a woman who was probably a prostitute. This woman is a well-respected woman, actually, and John names her and says it's Mary, the sister of Lazarus. So we've got a different story, different account, different timeline, similar occurrence, and very definitely, you know, the second event brings back to everybody's mind the first event. So there's powerful connection between the two, but that's not what I want to preach about today. I just want to make sure you get that separate event separated out in your mind. Everybody with me? You guys are falling asleep. Turn to your neighbor, just slap him a little bit, say, hey, wake up. Oh, go ahead. Come on, you can do it. Just for fun. Go ahead. Tell them, hey, he said get up and pray. Just kidding. Okay, in this event, what we have is Jesus on his way into Jerusalem, 6 days before the Passover, according to the Gospel of John, this event takes place. Now, in this account, it says at the beginning, 2 days before the Passover, they plotted against Jesus. So what I need you to see is the sandwich. You have on Wednesday, 2 days before Friday's trial and crucifixion, on Wednesday, Caiaphas and the leaders are plotting against Jesus, and Judas goes and gets 30 pieces of silver and promises to betray him. Okay, that happens on Wednesday. The previous Saturday, Jesus has been anointed by Mary in the house. Okay? Got it? That's important. It's important for this reason. Matthew's bringing it to our understanding so he can compare and contrast events that took place on different days, but because he's trying to give us a picture of true discipleship. We've got a contrast between a guy who was called to be a disciple of Jesus, who walked with him for 3 years, who had the privilege that you and I would love to have had. I mean, how many of you wouldn't have loved to be one of the 12? Wouldn't you just love that? To be right there, to be walking with Jesus, to observe those miracles, to hear his own words, and then to take that, to have that torch lit in your heart and be the carrier of that flame in all the world. Oh, how awesome would that be? Of course, we have the same commission, but it would have been awesome to see him face to face, right? Judas was one of the 12. He walked with Jesus. He saw all of that. He heard the very words of God, but he was not a follower. He was not a true disciple. He betrayed Christ because his expectation in going into it was, what can I get out of this? He was going into the relationship looking for friendship with benefits. That's what he was looking for. He wasn't willing to make a commitment to Christ that required of him the laying down of everything that was himself. And I want to tell you, Christianity that says to you, you can be you and be the best you that you can be, is missing the point. It's missing the point. Christianity is not about being the best you can be. It's about laying down your life. Jesus even models it for us. And he says to us, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it does not produce. But if it falls into the ground and it dies there, it will bear fruit and it will bring back 100-fold more. Here's what God is telling us through this incredible, incredible lesson. Simple as it may be, he is saying to us that we will not find true life until we're willing to give up our own. We will not find what it means to be part of the family of God. We won't be Christians. We won't be adopted into God's family until we're ready to let go of the family we were a part of. You can't be adopted unless you say, yes, I want to leave behind the old and I want to be a part of the new. You can't be part of two families. You can only be part of one. You can't be married to someone while at the same time being married to someone else. Do you see the picture? It's so evidently clear. Judas was going into it looking for what he could get out of Jesus. And our Christianity sometimes is so weak and so shallow and so false that we think the only reason I'm here is because, well, I was told maybe I'd be able to break some addictions. Maybe I could get over some issues. Maybe Jesus would bring peace to my life. Maybe I could, I could have a little reconciliation. Maybe, I'd make better decisions and I'd advance a little bit and elevate a little bit and, jump classes or something. Somehow, if I hang out with Jesus long enough, it's going to benefit me in the long run. So I'm going to stick with this until I see the reward. And my friends, that's not right. Because here's what God does. He tests every one of us. You make a commitment to Christ and you say, Jesus, I'm coming to you. I'm giving my heart to you. And you think, well, that's it. The preacher said everything's going to get better from this moment out. Right? And then next week you lose your job. You say, man, it was easier when I wasn't a Christian. And then your friends start abandoning you. And then things start going wrong here and there and everywhere. And all of a sudden the money dries up and you say, well, God, I don't understand. What's happening to me? You promised you'd be here. And it seems like he's far away. And then you repeat with the psalmist, that one psalm, there's a psalm in, I think it's 87 or somewhere around there, there's no hope in the entire psalm. I mean, the whole psalm is, God, why have you forsaken me? Everything is dreadful. My whole life's falling apart. The end. I mean, seriously. And I'm so glad that psalm is in there because it shows us the extent of the depth to which we sink. God, I don't get it. It gives me hope because it was actually recorded for us and kept in the Psalter. It's not really one we're going to put music to and sing on a Sunday morning, but I'm glad it's in there because it gives me hope that there were actually people who've gone through that and who survived that. Because God is not about to, he's not dishing out candy and saying, here, come believe. I mean, how would you feel about somebody handing candy to your kids and saying, come hang out at my house? Right? Why do we think God should be that way? True faith is not about what we can get. In the same way that true love is not about what we can get from a relationship. It's about what we give. So Judas is given, we've got the religious leaders, and they know right from the bat that they don't want to believe in Jesus. They're not interested. You know why? Because if they were to believe in Jesus, they would lose their status, they would lose their career, they would lose everything precious to them, and they're not even interested. So don't even go there. That's the sandwich bread on this side. On the other side of the sandwich, we have Judas Iscariot, and he thought for a while he could follow Jesus because maybe Jesus was going to elevate him, and he'd be part of Jesus' new administration and the new government that he's setting up. Not working out that way for him, so he's willing to turn him over for 30 pieces of silver. By the way, did a little research, 30 pieces of silver would be equivalent to about 4 months' wages. Okay, so it's no small sum, but it's not a big sum either. 30 pieces of silver is the amount of money that it would cost to redeem a slave, a male servant, according to the book of Exodus. So that's it. He's basically saying, well, I'm going to turn Jesus in for 30 pieces of silver, 4 months' wages. But here's the part that Judas didn't quite get. And it's a part that we don't get when we have to make that trade-off. We're thinking, what can I get, or what's going to happen to me out of this? Judas thinks he's getting 30 pieces of silver, but actually he is selling himself for 30 pieces of silver. There's a trade-off. Do you understand the difference here? He's not getting anything. He's giving up something of greater value for something of lesser value. When you go to the store and you part with your hard-earned cash to buy whatever item it is that's in front of you, you're thinking, well, this is a decent trade-off, right? You look for a couple of coupons, you try to get a good deal, but in the end, you walk home with a product and you say, hey, I made a decent trade. You hope. But there was a trade-off. There's always a trade-off. And Judas may think, he may have thought, well, this is a good deal for me. It's a win-win. I hand Jesus over. They give me 30 pieces of silver. I lose nothing. Jesus is the one who gets, you know, he has to pay the price. I get the money. I've lost nothing. But actually, that's not how it worked. Judas sold his soul. He himself became a slave. The 30 pieces of silver to redeem a slave, he took those 30 pieces of silver to sell himself into slavery. And there was no redemption from where he went. None at all. I ask you the same concept when it comes to whatever it is you're willing to sell Jesus out for. Because all of us have a testing point. There's a place where we get pressed. The buttons get pressed. What am I willing to? Where am I going to draw the line? This is as far as I go with the whole Jesus thing. Recently, Luke and I were depositing some money of his in a bank account, and he had a savings account, one of those passbook saving passbooks, and where they take the book and they just run it through and they put the balance on the bottom of it and whatever. And it's not a whole lot of paperwork there. You don't have an online account. They don't send you an account reckoning in the mail. It's just whatever's on the passbook, that's your money. So we went in, we took his paycheck. He had, I don't know, $300 or something he deposited in his account, and the computers went down as they were putting the little bank book through. So unbeknownst to us, what they did was they actually put the check through twice. So he got a double deposit in his account. Sounds like good, doesn't it? He's on his way to college. This is like, thank you, God, for your provision. Hallelujah. Right? And so he didn't even know about it. I mean, he hasn't been paying attention to that passbook. He just, you know, puts it in and gives it to me because he knows all the money's going to Dad anyway. So he just hands over the passbook. Here you go, Dad. Take care of it. And I'm going through later and I'm making a reckoning of his account as based against my own handwritten reckoning of his account, because I keep records. I'm a little, you know, okay. I keep every receipt from everything, from all time. 20 years ago, I bought a pizza, and I still got the records for it. But, so I was going through the record, and I found a double deposit, and I was like, wait a second, this isn't right. And so in that moment, of course, there's always that little voice that says, well, don't you think that's the way God's providing? You prayed for a little extra. There it is. The bank doesn't know. They don't care. They got millions of dollars. What do they care about this, right? They didn't even notice it. They don't know it's missing. They'll never know, right? And for a brief moment, I didn't even think about it. But it's there. It comes across your desk. Maybe it's not $300. Maybe it's an extra dollar of cash that they get back to you at the cash register, and you're thinking, well, that's great. It would take more effort to go back and give them their cash back than it would for me just to keep this, and you know what, they'll tally up, whatever, they'll figure it out. And you say, thanks, Lord, for the extra provision. I don't know where you get tested in terms of your integrity, but if I were to take that extra $300, it would not be a free gift. There would be an exchange. I would be exchanging something for that $300. And what I would be exchanging would be my integrity. If I took it and didn't say anything about it, eventually the bank would come around, because they're good record keepers too, and probably much better than me. They've got people who paid to keep the records, all right? They'll go back and they'll discover the $300 missing, and then they'll approach me and say, oh, by the way, Mr. Eskeland, Reverend Pastor Eskeland, we noticed that you didn't tell us about this. We've backed it out of your account, but from now on, we know and you know. And that's all we have to say. I will have sold my integrity for $300. And I tell you what, my reputation is worth a lot more than $300. My integrity is worth a lot more than $300. I'm not willing to make that trade. Judas wasn't wise enough to see what he was giving up. Are you? So maybe next week I'll take the bank book in and we'll just, you know, I'm just kidding. I've already done that. I've already done it, guys. You can relax. I knew that. When I took the bank book in, they said, wow, thank you. That's really wonderful that you would say that. We knew, but thank you. And I said, yeah, that's not my money. And I don't want it. It belongs to you.